OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
Now, you're welcome along to the football show. Later on, we'll be talking to the goalkeeping coach with Colombia, who it turns out is from Dublin. Des McLennan has had a very interesting life in football. He is going to join us in a short while. But first, footballers here at home are every bit as affected as those around the world, if not more so, given we're talking about a summer league. To discuss, we have Stephen McGuinness with us, General Secretary of the PFAI. Hiya, Stephen. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good.
Tell us what's the latest. Where are we?
I suppose from a league perspective, the players, we have 50% of the players on just COVID payments. The clubs aren't in a position to pay their current salaries. And we obviously have 50% of the players then who have the clubs are utilising the COVID payments and topping them up. So that's where we are. So we've basically 50% of the players in the Premier Division laid off, and then of the players in the First Division who are under contract, all of them haven't been paid since the pandemic started. The majority in the First Division would have other jobs, but there's not a huge amount. It's about 40 players that are under contract there. So we're in a position at the moment where the players are frustrated in the fact that it's taken so long to have it, to get a plan together in where the game is going. And we understand obviously that that the clubs are in huge they're under huge financial pressure. We understand that. We understand that the FAI does a hell of a lot going on there. But it is getting to the point here now where we do need a clear plan of how we're going to hopefully get football back.
Yeah. Just might not be possible. I mean, the GAA were able to give their members a clear answer because, frankly, those members aren't reliant on an income. It would be, we could turn around and say to League of Ireland players, well, it's off, cancelled, done. And that would be clarity in an expedient way. But maybe that's not the priority right now.
No, but I suppose when you look at summer football in Europe, there's 12 leagues which play summer football. 10 of them have a plan and a return date due to my own role within FIFPro, the World Players Union. I'm aware of obviously the situation at other countries, the likes of Finland, Iceland, Faroe Islands, who all have a planned return date. The latest being July 1st for Finland. So they have all plans in place, and I don't think players are looking for an unrealistic time frame to return. I just think they need to know what's happening, because I mean they're obviously training with Zoom, and their clubs are giving them plans. But I think, like any player, you have to know when is it reasonable to think that we're going to return and put in a reasonable date, and let's work towards that. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, especially when they're only on COVID payments, and there's obviously this talk from a government perspective that they may be adjusted in mid-June, it's a perilous position when you think that the majority of our players as well are out of contracts at the end of the season and are facing into a really, an uncertain future. And I think it's reasonable to ask the people who run the game to have a plan and a date for when you're going to return back to work.
Yeah, and I'm not unsympathetic to anybody's situation. If we dig into those numbers, so you mentioned the 12 countries who have summer leagues. There are 55 member nations in UEFA. Dan McDonald explored all this brilliantly in his piece this afternoon or this morning in the Irish Independent. It's on the website. So of the 55 member nations with UEFA, 12 of them are operating summer leagues. And so the only two which at the moment lack some kind of plan and clarity are Ireland, absolutely, and Moldova as well. Now, these include the likes of Belarus. They've continued on regardless. I mean, so that's like a basket case. We can discount that. They've just ignored COVID for a start.
Yeah.
If we get down to the nub of the problem here, and Dan had these figures, based on 2018 figures, the key stat for Ireland is that 28% of income comes from spectators through the games. And that is a bigger amount than any of those other summer leagues. So more so than any other country. I mean, Sweden is not incomparable, but they have the guts of €20 million in TV money coming in, which the Irish League just doesn't have. So you have 28% of income coming in through the gates. And then on top of that 28%, another 42% comes from commercial heading, which includes, you know, fundraising, match sponsorship, all of these things, which not having people through the gates will, if not eradicate, it certainly won't help. So this is a really tricky situation. The lack of TV money, the fact that we're at the start of a summer league, you know, if we're looking at the Premier League and contracts there, then they're mostly paid up, whereas the League of Ireland clubs here potentially have a huge bill if football doesn't come back. So I'm sympathetic to everybody, not least the players, but I understand this is tricky for the FAI and for the League of Ireland clubs as well. Have you been told when you're going to get information? I understand that there's a meeting on Friday between league and government.
Yeah, we're part of a steering group, which is hugely important, and I suppose that shows maybe where, from an FAI perspective, things have changed. So, as a players' association, we're part of a steering group that involves the clubs,
right,
the FAI, and the referees. That's something.
You're not ignoring each other in the canteen anymore. That's good.
We're not in the building anymore, so that makes the life a bit easier. But you're right. The relationships are better.
Good.
And from that perspective, that's been hugely helpful. So we've been able to relay information back to our members, and we have a call with all the delegates directly after every meeting to ensure that the players are in the loop and they're aware of what's going on. So that's been hugely helpful. And what that has allowed us to do, to understand then piece by piece what way we're going. It's just it's been quite slow. And at our recent meeting, it has been said that there will be a plan put to the clubs early next week, which will look at how we get back to playing. Because I think one of the biggest things is obviously the financial side of things. And a number of clubs have made it known publicly that they worry from a financial perspective of going to play behind closed doors and what financial effect that would have on the club. And we as a players association completely understand that and get that, and I suppose that's something that the FAI have to minimise that risk and minimise that amount that clubs could potentially lose and going behind closed to ensure that our members get paid and the clubs survive. So we are part of it. We do expect a plan early next week. There is discussions, as you rightly said, with government over the weekend and this week with the chief medical officer of the FAI to ensure that the health and safety piece of it is squared off, and ultimately then that we have the financial piece of it, which ultimately the clubs will decide whether to go back to play or not. It's not an FAI decision, it will be a club decision. And like one of the things myself and Ollie and Simone did today was to survey all our players. So we gave them until tomorrow afternoon, but we have a good chunk of 256 players respond to us. There is 300 professional players in the league. 87% of our members want to go back to training, and 87% want to go back to playing games. So there's a huge amount of guys that want to return. Obviously, they want to return in the safest environment possible. 92% said that they would like testing, if possible, twice a week. How possible that is, we don't know, but they're the types of, and there's a lot more information that have been flowed to the FAI from the players over the last couple of weeks to ensure that they're aware of what players would like in place if and when they return.
Because I know clubs have submitted estimates of revenue shortfalls based on behind closed doors games. And I saw as well that Stuart Gillooly, the lawyer with the players' union, he tweeted over the weekend that every effort should be made to restart. Players' contracts need to be honoured and there is no force majeure or get-out clause. So again, if that is the case in all the players' contracts, no force majeure or get-out clause. So what happens here, Stephen, if things get sticky, if the clubs put forward their estimates of revenue shortfalls and it just doesn't make sense for them and they can't really pay the players, and if the FAI, who last time I checked were 50 million in debt, go to the government and say, we need this thing to be subsidised to get us through this season, and the government say, well, join the queue, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to do that. And if players' contracts have to be honoured, are we looking here at clubs going into administration? I mean, what's the solution here? Someone's going to have to pick up the tab.
Yeah, that wouldn't be something that, obviously, from the players' point of view, the union's point of view, the league, everybody, nobody wants to see that.
No.
And I think we have a track record of working with clubs to ensure that from a financial viewpoint, that we ensure that it's not in our benefit to see a club go to the wall. It would affect our current members and affect the next group of players that come along that are trying to find employment in professional football. So that's not something that we would want. But ultimately, as you said earlier, there is no get-out clause in the contracts for both parties, by the way, on either side. So there has to be that coming together of minds of us all sitting around the table and saying, okay, how do we get through this? And that's something, like, we're not an association that turns around and bangs tables and demands they must be honoured. There is a starting point where the contract must be honoured. But like everything, we have to negotiate and we have to discuss it with the clubs. There'll obviously have to be openness from the clubs as well in regards to their accounts and how their business is run and all that. And as I said already, it's not in our interest for any club to go to the wall. It's not in the interest of the current players or the players that are next going to come back into the league or going to move. We know there's a huge amount of movement of players every year. So we hope to avoid that. I think that's why we're eager to see football back. That's why the FAI are working with the clubs to try and find a solution to this. And I think UEFA have been quite they have come out publicly and said that they want leagues to get back up and running. I think it'd be hugely damaging to our game if we were out of football for 7 or 8 or 9 months. To resurrect it after that, I think, will be hugely difficult. And that's why I think everything has to be done to try and get our game back. Again, one or two of the clubs have come out negatively against behind closed doors and streaming, and I can understand that. But you would just like them to be open-minded enough to look at the figures. And when they come early next week, have a look at it. If it's doable, we would implore them to do it, to be honest, and hope that we can get our game back. Because, to be honest, if we were closing down and reopening in February or March of next year, I think the damage to the game could be irreparable.
But is it doable if 28% of income comes from spectators and then another 42% is very linked to spectators and there's no TV money? Is it doable without government support or without UEFA reaching into their pockets as well? I mean, like, if the government don't subsidise it and UEFA don't and the clubs open their books to you, I think unfortunately you will be looking at a situation in several cases where the money just isn't there to honour those players' contracts.
Yeah, I think UEFA, I think we've exhausted all financial assistance from there. I think if there is a financial assistance, it will be coming from FIFA. I do think that there is, that the FAI have a plan, whether it's from a government perspective, they have a plan. They wouldn't divulge the information to us yesterday in the meeting, but they do have a plan and a financial assistance plan for the clubs to return. Is that enough for them to return? Does it cover the gap? And that's what the clubs will have to discuss with the FAI. But again, as I said to you already, we're open to discuss it with the clubs. We've four of our clubs who hope to play in European competition this year, and the financial benefits to that are huge. So we are hopeful that football can return and that we have four teams that are playing in European competition, and obviously that will assist. The current COVID payments assist our clubs. Can that be extended? I think that has to be discussed in relation to the extension of that to industries like ours, who are hugely affected by the facts of not having crowds into the ground. And just on another thing, a lot of the clubs have sold season tickets in advance, and a lot of that money has probably been utilised now. But government are paying 2/3 of the current salaries of the players as we speak. So there is a huge amount of assistance to the clubs. But that's to a point. Look, as I said to you already, we are open to discuss with clubs at all times. And we've already done deals with the clubs in relation to players' contracts. A number of the players have extended our contracts on to a later date, which was December, and would go 6 weeks unpaid, and they just extend their contracts out with a number of clubs. So our players have already assisted the clubs and will be willing to sit down and relook at it again, depending obviously on the financial package that the FAI put to the clubs next week.
Okay, so that will be next week we get that. And on a blanket point of view, you're not ruling out potentially players accepting pay cuts if it meant clubs survived and seasons could happen?
Shamrock Rovers took a 25% pay cut. We have a number of clubs who the players will go 6 weeks unpaid because they have extended their contracts out and absorbed that into the rest of their contract. So players have already done a lot, with 50% of them now not getting paid at all. So
No, it's a thoroughly
I don't know how miserable you can
it's a,
that.
No, it's a thoroughly miserable situation. I mean, it's just incredible what's happened, and summer football is particularly affected because we are at the start of all these seasons, at the start of all these contracts. It's just a nightmare scenario. I'm sure you're hearing horror stories from players who had absolutely banked on having this money, and there's no easy solution. Do you talk regularly to all the clubs, Stephen? Is there good cooperation there, or do you go through the FAI?
There would be a lot of cooperation with the clubs. Obviously, the clubs who have done, who we've come to an arrangement with in relation to the players' contracts, and we'd have a close relationship to them. There's some clubs who closed off pretty early in regards to being able to top up salaries, but we would have a close relationship with most clubs. It's just the nature of the business, and we would have a really good working relationship with the majority of the clubs in the league. So we would understand in each individual case the challenges that each individual club has.
Mm. So to round things up, we're hoping next week there's a bit of a plan, a bit more of a framework, maybe some dates in mind, and clubs can start pitching towards those dates and players know when they can come back. What about the safety aspect here? And this is the elephant in the room for every league, the Bundesliga right through to the Premier League and what they're grappling with right through to here at home. I'm sure you read Killian de Gascon, for instance, recently in the Irish Times. And I'm sure you listened to John Horan on the Sunday Game, who said, quite frankly, as long as there's social distancing, and that's a priority, we won't have Gaelic games because social distancing and contact sport don't really go hand in hand. So the safety of players here, say we get the money in place, say we get the dates in place, and players will be happy to go back and play because I'm sure they're desperate to do so. Yep. But they also need to be protected. I mean, are we looking at will we have an insistence on 24-hour testing on the eve of the game, on the morning of the game, and maybe results back before kickoff? Like, why? Because even Killian de Gascon made the point, even 24-hour testing is imperfect. At some point in that 24 hours, you will go from negative to positive. Your viral load will hit a certain point and you will be contagious. And these are the scenarios that we're talking about here when we try and balance the books between livelihoods and lives. So talk to us about that, because I know that's going to be a huge concern for you and for your members.
Yeah, it is. I suppose the chief medical officer in the FAI, the HSE, the government, everybody is involved in this. And I suppose what we're looking at is a scenario where the government have said they want social distancing in everything bar the 90 minutes, which is, so from a training perspective, that social distancing would be recognised by our clubs, by our players. So we would have to change the way that we train. The coaches would have to change how they coach our players. And there would be a new norm in regards to training. What you would then have is the 90 minutes of the game then, which potentially then would, that's where the social distancing would break down for 90 minutes. As soon as the 90 minutes was over, then you go back into social distancing again. That is at the moment the types of discussions. Now, the discussions only start this week in regards to how we're going to get back into the game. There's lots of studies. I seen one in Denmark, the Daily Telegraph done it today, who said that players are only within 2 metres of each other for less than 2 minutes in every game. So there's lots of studies out there, lots of information that has to be correlated and looked at to see how safe it is for our players to return. It's clear from the players, 92% of them said in a survey today, they want to be tested on a regular basis. So we have to take that on board. And how we manage to get the bones of 700 people tested, because that's the type of numbers you're talking about when you talk about referees, players, staff at clubs. That's a hell of a lot of people to be tested every week. And that's a challenge for our game and a challenge for the chief medical officer, the FAI, to see how we are going to do that. But our players for sure want testing to be implemented and to ensure that the athlete that they're competing against and their teammates at a starting point for sure before they go back to training, they would want it. There's a COVID-19 officer in place at the club to ensure that all the principles and protocols that are agreed are then implemented, because there is a chance here that you put everything in place and after a week or two it gets a little bit loose. It needs somebody around that's independent, that's going to ensure that the protocols, one of them which is that the manager can only speak for the players for 10 minutes, that doesn't roll, that we suddenly don't break into five-a-sides in training. So there is a, how would you say, from a player's perspective, the worry that this has to stay in place in the long term or until we get a vaccine. Our sport is probably slightly safer than the other, but Gaelic and rugby, because the ball in the hands, but there is physical contact. You can't get away from that.
Yeah.
So what the key thing here is from our game's perspective, is to lower the risk as minimum as possible. How can we make the risk as small as possible? And that's the job of our game, to protect the athlete and to protect, in this case, the player. Because he's the only one where social distancing breaks down. For the manager, for the referees, that's in place. But for the players, it's not. So we have to minimise the risk. And if that means a minimum amount of time for a pre-season, so instead of 6 weeks, it's only four. From a training point of view, that we have to keep social distancing in all training sessions and only lift it for 90 minutes. That's something that our players will do. We are waiting for guidance this week from the HSE and guidance from the medical officers of the FAI to ensure that the safety of the player, and in all the meetings I've been at, the number one priority in every meeting I've been at, everybody has said the same, which is the priority is the safety of the player. Yeah. And that has never not been the case. We spoke about finances a minute ago, but the reality is the safety. The finances don't come into it if the safety in any way, shape or form, the player is in any jeopardy. So there is going to be risk, we know that, but how do we minimise that risk?
Two last quick points. In conversations with the HSE or in conversations with Chief Medical Officer or the FAI's Medical Officer, has the ethics of using all these tests been discussed?
From the Chief Medical Officer's point of view, first of all, we have to get it that it's agreed that it can be done, and that's number one. Where are they going to be tested? What stage will public testing be at that stage?
Mm.
So if it's at a situation where public testing is potentially at 100,000 and we're looking for 700 tests, is that doable? And they're the discussions, obviously, that have to take place. Nobody wants to see frontline workers not being tested and footballers being tested. Nobody wants to see that. But if we're at a capacity perspective and that from a public point of view, that the only field sport potentially that's going to be played at that time, testing can be done, obviously, that would be ideal. If not, there's a huge cost, you would think, to have testing done elsewhere. So that's obviously up to the Chief Medical Officer of the FAI and up for the relevant bodies that are involved to investigate that and look at it. But from a player's perspective, there's no way would you want people on the front line or people in public not getting tested because professional footballers wanted it.
And a last one, Stephen, even before all this kicked off, so you mentioned things, the relations have been good with the FAI in the midst of this COVID crisis, and that's great, because I do remember speaking to you, I don't know how many months ago, but was slightly aghast that whatever the issue was at that particular time, I can't even remember, but it seemed like a conversation couldn't happen, even though you're sharing the same building as the FAI CEO as he was then, and relations were at an all-time low. Post that rather dysfunctional situation into this new era, even pre-COVID, have things been better? Have communications been opened? Does it feel like a new era to you in the FAI?
It does. I mean, it'd be very difficult to be any worse, being blatantly honest with
right.
you. It would be very difficult to be worse.
How bad, by the way, was it at an all-time low? Like, are we talking, it was years here where it was just on the floor of that relationship?
I can't describe to you, but you would have no cooperation. You would have nobody willing to work with you. You would have walking into canteen with people getting up and walking away, nobody sitting beside you. You would find it awkward to walk around. There'd be no communication. It was very difficult. No assistance, couldn't use the pitches outside for training for our hour contract players. I mean, I can't tell you what it was. It was difficult, but I suppose from our own perspective and from a PFA perspective, we had a job to do. And because people didn't like maybe the way that we did it and maybe the way that we challenged the leadership of the FAI at the time, that the people who sat underneath the leadership roles felt they had no choice but to implement what was being said to them. So that was, and I felt sorry for them, and it was hugely difficult, because these are people we've been in that building over 10 years. These are people we've built up huge relationships with, and overnight the relationship falls apart, and privately to be saying to you, look, it's nothing personal, but this is the directive that we've got from the top. So that was disappointing. But look, things have changed. There's new people in there now. There's a new board. There's Niall, and obviously Gary Owens have gone in. We deal more with Niall. I have to say he's been open. You can contact him. You can talk to him. you can challenge him, you can speak to him. He understands the game, he understands the challenges that the players face. Look, we're not always going to agree with things. We obviously not. I'm not always going to agree with what Roy Barrett says, what Gary Owen says, or what Niall says. But the difference now is that you feel part of it. Like, there's no way we were a part of a steering group a year ago. No chance. Players' voices wouldn't be heard. And now the conversation, and look, our own relationship with government is better, so we're able to get answers for our players from government as well, where before that was cut off as well. So look, it's hugely important for the players, for their voice to be heard. And they feel more part of the game, and so do we. And that's vital, I think, for any functioning organisation. Every stakeholder should feel part of it. And for too long within football, the stakeholders felt no part of the game, and it was being dictated from the very top. I see a dramatic change in that. Is it perfect? No, it's not. Are we working better together? Yes, we are. So we're at the start of it. But for sure, from the likes of Niall and Gary and from Roy Barrett, you absolutely can contact him. You will be listened to. Now, we're not expecting us all to agree and everything sure. to be done.
It's a working relationship.
It is. Yeah. I look jealously at times at the GPA relationship with the GAA and the rugby union players and their relationship and how they work together. And jealously, you'd look at it and say, Jenny, how can we work like that? Surely that's easily to do. We have challenges. We understand that. But definitely we're at the start of something where we are working together. And that's can only benefit the game. And hopefully, as I said, that continues to grow.
OK, well, listen, busy few weeks for you, to say the least. General Secretary of the PFAI, Stephen McGuinness. Thanks, Stephen. We wish you well.
Same to you. Thanks a lot.
OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties. One county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that gold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7:30 AM on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
Now, you're welcome back. Really looking forward to talking to our next guest. His name is Des McLeanan. You may well have heard his name down the years. He comes from Artane in Dublin, and he has ended up as the Colombian goalkeeping coach. And plenty has happened in between as well. Des, how you doing? You're welcome to the show.
Great pleasure. And I'd just like to say, listen, anytime I'm home, I always look forward to listening to the show. You do a stellar job. It's a quality show. Always enjoy listening.
Oh, great. Well, listen, you're very kind to say. So I'm pretty sure, I haven't checked this, but I'm just going to go out on a limb and say you're the first fella from Artane to end up coaching goalkeeping in the Colombian international team. I reckon, I would think.
I would say so. Probably the first, well, I have a US passport too, so I would be the first US coach to have coached a national team in South America, and certainly a team of the caliber of Colombia.
Will we start at the beginning for a moment? You played for Stella Maris growing up. You were a goalkeeper growing up.
Yeah, I played for Stella Maris. The first club I ever played for was Vianney Boys, which is the local club around the corner. It would be in the estate that I live in. I played for them. I played for a team called St. Columbans up in Clonshock. I played for, and then I played for Stella. Played some Leinster senior with Belgrove. My happiest days were down on St. David's with Brian Talty, and we had a formidable team. We won a U15 All-Ireland Championship. So happy days.
You went over to university in the States. I think ultimately you end up in Central Connecticut State University. That's when you first make your first kind of your foray into coaching over there.
Initially, I went over, and it was the guy who brought me over was a member of a very well-known, I would have to say, football dynasty in Ireland, the Kennys. The older brother was Sean, Mark, Paul, all the Kennys. It was Sean Kenny who brought me over, and I went to a small college in Concordia, Concordia College, Bronxville, New York. But then I got a lucky break. I transferred out of there and got a full scholarship at Central Connecticut State in hard-hitting New Britain.
When does coaching start to come into your life?
When you needed to make a few shillings, it was, there wasn't any sort of, there wouldn't have been a coaching business, and there was no coaching in Ireland of any shape, way, or form. So, camps are always a huge part of the American culture. Mm. So when somebody offered me a chance to coach kids, a summer camp, I jumped at the chance. And to be honest, I found it was something that I really loved. To be honest, you couldn't wish for a better apprenticeship or a better way to spend the summer with out in the outdoors, getting a nice tan, and with a lot of good company, a lot of characters over the years, a lot of stories. So that's how I started. That was really my first job in the U.S. was coaching, and it was something I found I really took to and I liked. And for me, it wasn't working, because it's not. Regardless of what people say, anyone who's in the coaching game, it is not work for me.
Broadcasting's pretty similar, trust me. So is this kind of how you spent a lot of your years? Maybe I know you went over there the late 80s, so the kind of the 90s, was it doing camps and enjoying yourself
doing
and coaching?
Camps,
that was
and,
it?
But there was one guy who actually worked for Carlos Quiroz for many years, but before he worked for him, he had one of, I suppose, the most prominent goalkeeper education programs in the States, a guy called Dan Gasper. So I worked for him, and he was a pretty flamboyant character. And I suppose he introduced me to really, I suppose, breaking down, although I wouldn't fully agree with a total philosophy, but he was very good at breaking down technique and organizing the week. And it was the first time I really seen how you would tackle teaching goalkeeping to kids or to anyone from sort of the nuts to bolts. And that was my intro. And I worked for his camp for many years and then became a director. And as a director, I would travel all over the U.S. and coach anything from 15 to 100. I would be a director. So that's really where I cut my teeth. Mm. It's no different than the music business. You hone your skills every night, or the people do in bars, doing gigs, and it's no different in, it's not the coaching courses. You got to get out and find your own style, find your own way, find your own methodology, and put your stamp and your personality on it. So,
do you coach every goalkeeper in the same way, or do you have to work to their attributes and their body size and their technique?
You manage the personalities you deal with. For example, right now, I have David Ospina, huge experience, left Colombia when he was 16. Mm. So his formation would have been in France with the club he was at. I can't recall the club he was at. So he was in France, and then he spent many years with Jerry Payton and Peter Cech, and we speak about that. And when these guys come in, they just—it's like food. They want a good menu. They don't want to be eating potatoes cooked the same way every day. You got to be able to serve up the basic staples, but in a different way, with a fresh approach. And he really liked my style. He really liked the things I brought to the table. And we struck it off from day one. And it's almost a large part of you has to be a psychologist. You have to be able to read people, especially if you're dealing with an experienced goalkeeper. You can't bullshit them. They don't want to be bullshitted. Mm. And they can see right through you. And they will eat you up. Younger guys are more malleable. You can put more of your stamp on them. The older guys, you have to be very suggestive. And particularly with the national team, I valet park the cars. The cars come in with a full tank. They better go back with a full tank. And the owners don't want to see the dents or scratches in the paintwork.
And
so
if
you've got to come...
If we extend your food analogy for a second, give me an example of your chef special when David Ospina comes in and you need to keep him interested. What are you doing with him? What kind of drills or what?
In goalkeeping, you've got to present very similar elements every day. There's got to be a solid basis of hands, feet. I like to do one or two exercises on the ground before we get onto the ground. You've got to have some low balls, some medium balls. And then we've got to start the ball moving around. So every day I'm able to serve up that sequence in a whole variety of ways. Mm. And sometimes in the way that you will see somebody cooking on a certain day, they might be able to try something else and just bring a little different flavor to it. Mm. Or the way a musician will, if there was an interview with Van Morrison recently, and Van Morrison says, you know, he never sings the same song the same way. He'll never sing it the same way. There'll always be a twist to it. And that's what I do. I stick to a formula, but there's a twist to it all the time. And you have to have a really good feel for rhythm. Good rhythm, good service. And you have to obviously know it has to reflect the demands of whatever the session is going to be. But in general, at the national team level, we have very little time to operate. Mm. You would be blessed if you got 40 minutes.
Okay.
I mean, you have to steal time by starting as quick as possible and being as efficient as possible. No real bullshit. Just things have to be organized, and the exercises have to flow. They have to make sense.
And you said their younger players are more malleable. Is there a goalkeeper now, Des, who almost embodies what you think is the perfect technique, you look at and you think that is the goalkeeper I would create from scratch?
You know what? That's how I sort of got in, and that was my approach to Ospina. I said, we had met, and you know what? I was very fortunate because I'm a very good friend with a guy called Juan Pablo Angel, who played for Villa, who you would know. And lo and behold, Juan Pablo was one of his very best friends. So that made life so much easier for me going into the session. When I was on my way to training session, there was a hurricane in Miami, and it was just me and Ospina, and I think Juan Cuadrado and a couple of other players, about four players, doing an indoor session. And, you know, I had the first day at school, nerves, you know, the little butterflies in the stomach. He came up and tapped me on the shoulder, and he handed me the phone. He says, "For you." I says, "Who's that?" He goes, and it was Juan Pablo. He goes, "Desi." I was going to swear there. He goes, "What the hell?" He says, "This is incredible." He says, "Oh, you're going to love David. He's a great guy. He's my best friend." And you know what? I felt like I was walking on air. Mm. But, you know, I said, "David, I have more respect for somebody like you." I says, "At your stature, because for a goalkeeper, who does not, it's a dirty word that I hate, profile. The profile now is 6'2 is small, 6'3, 6'4, 6'5, and they can move like cats." Mm. Ospina is no more than 6 at his 6 foot. And when you are that height, you don't have any wiggle room because people are always waiting for an excuse to say, you're not tall enough. Mm. And your leash is a lot shorter. You can't misplay any balls. Mm. Yeah, you have to know exactly what your range is, and your defenders have to know what balls you come for. And you know what? As Tony Meola, a guy I used to work with, said, "You just got to make all the plays you're supposed to make, and everything else will take care of itself."
If I hark back to your story, which we sort of began telling there a moment. In 2001, you hooked up with the Metro Stars in New York, now known as Red Bull, and you did 10 years there. I know you worked with Tim Howard pre his move over to Manchester United. Yeah, that was your first professional gig, yeah. 10 years in New York coaching professional football sounds great.
Oh, it was fantastic. I lived in, I don't know if any of your listeners would know New Jersey well, although it's called New York Metro Stars or New York Red Bulls. It's actually in New Jersey. I lived in a picture postcard village called Maplewood, and it was 40 minutes on the train to Manhattan. And it was idyllic. It was beautiful. Great, great memories, close to Hoboken. I'm a big music fan. And I started off with a bang. I mean, Howard was an up-and-coming goalkeeper. And he displaced the starting goalkeeper. There was very bad blood between the two of them. And I could sense it from day one, from I walked in. And after my first training session with the two of them, in which they didn't really talk, the guy's name was Mike Ammon. He got traded to DC United. And Howard was made the number one. And by the end of the year, in the beginning, I would say he was a bit reticent, a bit defensive, resistant, because he had a goalkeeper coach who he liked. And it was really, who am I? You know, it was my first professional coaching gig. And looking back, I really didn't know that much at all. Hmm. But I knew enough to get the job done. And then my forte would be, I think I've got a good personality. I'm a good listener. And I got a good eye. And, you know, I certainly didn't hurt his career. You know, I'm not going to blow my own trumpet, but at the end of the year, he'd made his debut for the full national team and won the goalkeeper of the year in the MLS and went to the All-Star game. So it was a great first year. I was on cloud nine.
If I force you to skip ahead here a little bit, so 10 years yep. around New York, that sounds like a joy in the music scene and New York's
it was fantastic.
A great place to
but
live.
But a lot yeah. of different coaches in there.
Yeah, I know, yeah. You survived a few regime changes, to say the least, which is good going.
Like big coaches, international coaches.
Bob Bradley, I think. Did you work under Bradley?
Bob Bradley, Bruce Arena.
Yeah.
Nice. Mo Johnston. I was Mo Johnston's roommate. That's a show in itself. great character. Hans Bakke, who was Sven Goran Eriksson's assistant. And Juan Carlos Osorio was at Man City, and he was the national team coach for Mexico. So yeah, a lot of coaches and fantastic memories.
I know you went out to Saudi Arabia then, which couldn't be more of a culture yeah. shock in Riyadh, I think. Not the most tolerant, equal society in many ways. I would suspect the nightlife was very different from New York. Was that an enjoyable time?
The nightlife consisted of, number one, unless you had pull and knew who to talk to, I learned to make my own vino. So you made your own wine. And there was a couple of Irish people on the compound, and one of them was Rory McIlroy's uncle. Lovely fellow. And our evenings of entertainment consisted of YouTube. Everyone got three choices of their favorite song. Normally live. He loved Bee's Wing by Ewan McCall. Always remember that about him. And we would drink the night away into the small hours, drinking the homemade red wine, and that would do the trick.
I read a piece on the 42 where you gave an interview, and you hit a dark spot in your life post Saudi Arabia, but I didn't understand yeah. why as such, or maybe there was no reason. There doesn't always have to be. But what age were you when you kind of you had your 10 years in New York and you went in Saudi Arabia for a while, and you get back to Ireland and you hit that state of depression, I think, without wanting to put words in your mouth. But what age are you then, and why did that happen?
I would have been in my 40s. So I came back from Saudi Arabia, and for the first time in my life, I'd gotten ahead financially, because it's tax-free. And you look at the money rolling into your account every month, and I made more there in a couple of years than I made in a lifetime. Mm. So I came back, and I've got a really good friend of mine, a guy called Johnny Vaughan. His brother Trevor played in the League of Ireland for many years. And that was really my home, where my support system was. Because when I came back to New Jersey, I'd been away 2 years, and I came back to not being a professional coach. And I sort of lost a bit of my identity. And it took me a while to get coaching again, and I couldn't get into the swing of it. And really, I should have went back up to Connecticut to the people who were nearest and dearest, because this guy's my best friend in the world. And I started to flounder. And like anyone will tell you, in the professional game, it's a huge part of your identity. And I got stuck and my wheel started to turn. And I just went into a very dark place that anyone who suffers from depression will tell you. It's like being lost in a very, very, very dark maze. And you can't see out, and you just have no sense of feeling. You lose interest in everything. There's just absolute desperation and an intense, numbing pain that just eats you away from the inside. And you just really want to die, because I've thought about it many times. And I struggled. I made a bad mistake. I went over to stay with my sister in London. She tried to help me. But really what I needed to was be coaching. Didn't have to be coaching professional. I don't know. I think the greatest thing, the greatest way you can feel in the world is not to make money or not to have material possessions. The greatest thing you can do in the world is to give. Give of yourself. Give something. Contribute. And the only thing I felt that I could really give, especially to children, was my knowledge. And I felt useless. I was cut adrift. I just wanted the pain to end. I just wanted the pain to end. It was, you have no pleasure. You lose all sense. You lose all taste. You're not hungry. You're not tired. You don't sleep. You're in bed, but you don't sleep. You lose all judgment. Couldn't feel anything. You just, for want of a better word, become absolutely numb. And there was a guy came over, and he's related to the Collins family. His name is John O'Rourke, and he works in the U.S. He sells products like Quickle for a big company, and he came over, and you know what? I don't know. He was able to say the right things to me. He knows me. He used to come to Red Bull, and we used to go into the canteen, and he has good banter. He's a real dub, and he's a solid bloke. I don't know, and he was... I don't know. He showed me some love. He made me feel that I was valued. And he said, look, he says, you've always wanted to learn Spanish. He says, I got a great mate in Mexico. You won't make much money. But he says, I'm sure he'd be delighted to have you. He says, why don't you get over there? So I slowly but surely got myself together. And I went down, and there was a guy called Noel Kelly in Stella Maris. And I went back, and I got myself together over the course of 2 or 3 months, and really enjoyed working with the kids. And, you know, he really enjoyed having me. And then when I felt well enough and rehabilitated myself, I left and I went to Mexico with no care about making money. And I rediscovered my passion for football, because you know, programs like this, only football exists over there. There's only football programs. And I fell in love with the people, with the country, with the language, with Mexican football. And I was coaching kids from 4 o'clock till 8:30 every night, long hours on the fields, games at 8 o'clock in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturdays and Sundays. And I loved it. I loved it, and, you know, I don't speak, I wouldn't say I speak well by any shape, way, or form, but I learned to speak the language, and when I was there, I reached out to a contact, a guy called Tab Ramos, who was probably one of the finest players to ever pull on the U.S. shorts. I said, look, Tab, you know, we work together. I says, obviously, you know, my CV, I've been away. I says, I'm back. I says, I'm in Mexico. I says, I'd love to get involved with the national teams, any chance? And he goes, yeah. He says, give me some time to think about it. So he got me involved in with the U20 national team, and it was I would be eternally grateful to Tab, because he allowed me back a foothold into the professional game. And, you know, it's a tremendous learning experience, just because it prepares you for international football, because it's only one step away on the rung on the ladder from the full international team. And generally with the US, we always played the best European opposition, England, Holland, Germany, you know, Spain, or we'd play Argentina and France. And, you'd get to see players like, Pogba and stuff, the U20s and stuff. And you begin to see what that level is like and the rhythm of international football. And I love the trips. I look forward to them. And I start working there with the 20s. I worked with the 18s. So I had a trip every 3-4 weeks. I was flying off somewhere, either a domestic camp in the US or an international camp with the 18s and the 20s. And that sort of went on for 2 years.
Wow. I don't want the clock to come.
But it's great to see the young talent coming up, because you see the next big
names. Yeah. I don't want the clock to come against us. Sorry, Des. But tell us then about Carlos Queiroz and Colombia. And I mean, football in Colombia, amazing thing in South America, so vibrant and exciting. It's a pretty exciting place, I would think, to be plying your trade. This has come about relatively recently.
Yes, you know what? I feel. I have a tremendous respect for knowledge, for people with it. So, I'm a huge Van Morrison fan, and, you know, you could throw Queiroz into the same category. He's a guy who's never taken a break. He bangs it out year after year. He needs to work. He doesn't ride off into the sunset and count his money. He loves to work. Mm. He's wise. He has a great passion for the game, a great knowledge. He's a great teacher. He's a great lover of all things Man United. And I feel very blessed to have the opportunity to have met him at this stage of his life. And, I've worked with some dicks, you know. I won't put it any other way. And, you wouldn't want to take Carlos lightly, but he's a lovely man. He's a lovely man. He's wise. And I think I got a good bond with him, and he loves his music. He loves the Beatles. He loves music. And he's got some great stories. You know, everyone thinks he's Portuguese. He's not. He's from Mozambique. Mm. So his heart beats, heart and soul is African. And, he's got an amazing track record. He was the really the father of coaching in Portugal, and he's inspired a whole generation of famous coaches. Anyone who's cutting their teeth now have all followed in his footsteps, and he's held in great reverence. And he understands British football as well as anyone. He's a great passion for it. When he went to Real Madrid, maybe it wasn't the right time to go, but when Real Madrid come calling, you know, you can't turn them down.
No, it's true. And he
was very beloved by Ferguson. He's a good guy. He's solid. He knows. He's a true football man. As I said, it's a great pleasure to work, especially at this stage of his life. I hope he has another gig in him. I'd love to work with him after this, but this has really pulled the rug out from under of us all. I mean, initially, I had a hard time with the disappointment, but then you're humbled. But when you realize the battles that other people have, and, you know, I don't have a young family. I'm not worried about paying a mortgage, and I don't have the fears other people have. And at the end of the day, I just kick a bag of wind at people, and people have real fears. But football now is at the mercy of politicians, and before that, it was the other way around. So I'd like to be optimistic, but we got some serious challenges, especially the international game.
No, there's no doubt. I know one of your first games was like 65,000 people against Brazil. So that's welcome to the big time. What have you learned about what have you learned about Colombian culture or Colombian football? Do you spend much time in Colombia?
I live in Colombia.
You live there? Okay.
I live in Bogota. And it's everyone thinks it's a very mountainous country, and the climate there is, it's very like Dublin. I mean, it's like a Dublin summer. It's cloudy and they think it's cold. It's slightly cool and it rains a lot because you're up in the mountains. Everyone thinks it's freezing. I don't, but so it rains a lot. It's mountainous, and the two big teams there, and I go to the games every week, and I'm sort of immersed in the culture, and I fly and I watch games, and obviously I travel to Italy to meet Ospina, or I would go to Mexico to meet Camilo Vargas. So you know, you pinch yourself and you think, wow, is anyone looking at this for the money? Am I getting paid for doing this? Because I'm robbing money here. Because it truly is a dream job. I'd like to be on the field every day, but it's not possible. But having this on my CV, you can't take away. But yeah, that debut was special because, you know, I would have loved to have either a friend or a family in the stand, because it was a big moment for me. My family aren't really football people and they don't really get it. So nobody really shared the joy for me. And but one of my best friends in football was sat on the other side of the bench. And he works with Neymar at PSG, has a contract with Neymar, works with him at PSG, but he's the fitness coach for Brazil. And we're always in constant contact. He's very, very humble man. He's a very spiritual man. And he, you know, he came out of the dressing room when I was warming up, and he came down and he gave me a big hug and a kiss. And he told me, look, you're here. You deserve this. Welcome. Welcome. Mm. And after the game, he introduced, I'd known Chichi from, I'd met him several times in the United Arab Emirates when I was over there visiting a friend of mine, Mick McDermott. And, had a big hug and a bit of a chat in the middle of the field, and Taffarel came over. It was one of these pinching moments, you know, because it was a cracking friendly. It was not like a it was a tempestuous affair. It was 2-2, blood and guts, stadium full, Hard Rock Cafe Stadium. I think it was 75,000, and it was something that I'll never forget. And unfortunately, now it seems like such a lifetime away. I mean, we were supposed to have been two games in, and we were supposed to be preparing to play Uruguay next, Ecuador. But everything has gone right out the window. By the time everything turns around again, you're reassessing who's playing, who's not playing. Some players who were on the bubble, on the cusp, 35, 36. I mean, we don't know. It's tough when you're that age. The players who are older will have a difficult time in this because it's hard to restart the engine. Even though they're training, they'll get back into the games, the kicks will hurt. They'll be sore after the games. But when you're at that age, with 35, 36, and you keep going, you're using the momentum.
Yeah.
But it's going to be tough for some players, and some players are going to suffer now, but... Yeah, you know, I try and stay optimistic. I try and stay hopeful. As I say, you got to be empathetic of the efforts that a lot of people are making, the suffering that a lot of people are making. And in Latin America, in Brazil, in most countries in South America, it's a country of the haves and the have-nots. And there's a lot of people living on the margin of poverty. Not saying there's not poverty here in Ireland, but we have a safety net. We have a social system where people get payments and stuff. And when stuff happens to you in Latin America, you're shit out of luck. And there's 10 people living in small apartments and stuff. And when they're deprived, they're not living paycheck to paycheck. They're living day to day. And they're good people. They're humble people. You know, they're God-fearing people and who are deeply qualified. A Catholic and put their faith in Jesus, and what must be they thinking now? You know, I worry for them, and you know, it breaks my heart to think about how a lot of people will suffer over there. And you know, as Carlos Quiroz said, we got a dream. We got to keep hope alive, and we got to try and come up with solutions, because when all is said and done, football has been will always be and will be again important for people and people's lives. So we have to remember that.
Mm.
So we have to be hopeful and let's not dwell on the negative.
No, absolutely. Des, I'll be honest, we're right out of time, and I'd say I've got to about 3 of the 10 things I planned to talk to you about.
Yeah.
Haven't even gone close. Haven't even scratched the surface.
Well, maybe another day.
Well, let's do part 2, because there's about 10 questions I want to ask on what we've just talked about, and then there's another few things I definitely want to get into, not least even your thoughts on the
not to blow smoke up your arse, but I do love the show. I do love listening to it, and I just would like to say that Johnny Giles is a national treasure.
Agreed.
I mean, I just, when he speaks, I mean, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. You know, because he's old school. He's good values. He's no nonsense. He's not of the pampered, you know, $30,000 watch covered in ink. You know, he's real. There's no bullshit with Johnny Giles. And he played for one of the – I'm fascinated by Leeds and the legacy and the way they went out and systematically took care of opponents and the stories. I like them as a columnist. When he's on the show, I was in the car the other day. I parked the car and I sprinted into the house and turned on the radio. I love listening to him. I love his descriptions about the players, that spot he's been doing where he's named the best 11 from from – I mean, long may he continue. If he listens to this show, I'd love to give him a big hug. I love Johnny Giles. He's a national treasure, and long should he continue and have a voice to be listened to, because when he speaks, he's got real things to say. I really love him. So if you ever talk to him again, please pass on my best wishes and tell him I'm a great admirer and I've always been.
Listen, 100%. He's on tomorrow. We'll make a point of playing that clip to him.
Please do. Please do. I'll be listening.
Des, let's do part 2 sometime in the next couple of weeks.
All right. Brilliant. Okay. Pleasure.
That'll be great. Des McLennan there talking to us about a whole host of things. He is the Colombian goalkeeping coach and has had an extraordinary life. Obviously talked about some very personal things there. If you were affected by them, and I appreciate lots of you may have been, then the Samaritans Helpline is a free phone number. It's available 24/7, and you'll get it on 116-123. So 116-123. The Samaritans are waiting if you want to have a chat with them about any of the issues which may have come up in that interview. So Des McLennan was his name. A fascinating fella. We'll do part 2 of them. I mean, we're in no rush over the next couple of weeks, so we'll chat to Des again at some stage.
OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties, one county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that bald spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7:30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.